Welcome, this is Ken McCarthy, and this is another meeting of the System Club. We've got two very intriguing guests. Before I introduce them, I want to give you a quick 12-month recap of where we've been in the last year. Exactly a year ago, we had the good fortune to be able to interview Gary Bensavenga, who, when he retired, was considered the number one money-making direct mail writer of his generation, and that's according to his clients, Agora, and Boardroom and Rodale, who happily wrote him multi-million dollar commission checks over the course of his career. We then had a great opportunity to review the work of the late, great Eugene Schwartz, along with Jay Abraham, and Gene was considered one of the best mail order booksellers of all time. We also spent an hour with Michael Fishman, who Brian Kurtz of Boardroom Books says is the best mailing list broker alive. And then we had an interesting experience talking with the producers of the Blair Witch Project. And if you remember those folks 5 years ago, they took a sort of a crappy movie, no offense to them, and produced for under $100,000 and sold over $250 million worth of tickets using some brilliant marketing plans and ploys. Today, we've got something really extraordinary. I don't think I've ever talked to two guys that have ever made so much money in my entire life and made it through a business that they owned. I mean, we've had a lot of advisors and copywriters and consultants on here that have helped companies make tens, hundreds of millions, and in a couple of cases over their lifetime career, even a couple of $1 billion. But we have two folks here who in a 10-year period sold over $500 million worth of stuff. They happen to use Direct Response TV, and I think a case can be made that these are the two greatest Direct Response TV marketers of all time. And I'm talking about Barry Boettcher and Ed Valenti. And you may not know their names, but I absolutely guarantee, no matter where you live on Earth or what language you speak, you know one of their products. They promoted many products, but you absolutely know their flagship product, the Ginsu Knife. Yes, today we're going to talk to the brains and brawn behind that amazing promotion, which still lives today. Can Barry and Ed, can people still buy Ginsu knives?
They can at GinsuGuys.com.
Great. And
by the way, I just have to tell you that I definitely agree with your statement.
Well, you know, I'm racking my brain.
We're very modest about it.
Yeah, but I mean, in the short form, I mean, there's infomercial guys, you know, and there's a lot of good work there. But in terms of the short form, and how long were your spots, by the way?
They were 2 minutes long.
Okay. Yeah, in terms of that time frame, I can't think of anybody that came close in terms of impact. By the way, now, Ginsu, I heard a rumor that it was acquired by Warren Buffett. Am I hearing that correctly? Or
Warren Buffett owns Ginsu right now.
Amazing.
Sure does.
Amazing.
As a matter of fact, if you go to one of his annual meetings, you can get Gillette blades outside the annual meeting hall, and you can buy Ginsu knives, pretty much every product he has. So if you need some Ginsu knives, you can buy them two places, Warren Buffett's annual meeting, or you can buy them at GinsuGuys.com.
Yeah, it might be a little more convenient to head over to GinsuGuys.com
and
get your
set. I would caution everyone listening that there are, of course, with everything else in life, a lot of copies.
Mm-hmm. We call them ripoffs,
especially around the internet.
People, are you kidding?
Product,
are you serious? People rip other people off?
Oh my goodness!
In the direct market?
Isn't that hard
I've
to
never
believe?
Heard such a thing.
Anyway, you'll find things that say "as seen on TV" or "genuine Ginsu knives," but unless the product is made by QuickCut, and that is the company that Warren Buffett owns, and they were originally from Ohio, and now they are residing in Arkansas.
Okay.
But unless it comes from that company, it's not a real Ginsu knife.
And, of course, they can just get them direct from your website.
Absolutely.
Right.
Where they can also get, and this is one of the reasons we're having this particular call, they can also get The Wisdom of Ginsu,
yes.
Which is a book that's just come out by Career Press, by Barry and Ed, and it contains the secrets behind their multiple business successes. And we're going to talk about all of them, not just the Ginsu knives. 24 hard-earned Ginsuisms.
They sure were hard-earned, and Ginsuisms are basically their rules and strategies that teach you how to be successful in your business and your personal life. And we have a Ginsuism for just about everything, like how to get people to return your phone calls when they don't return your phone calls,
mm-hmm.
how to negotiate better deals on anything, how to get people to always see you in a positive light, and many, many more. These are things that we've picked up over being partners for over 30 years, and we've decided to tell the world some of the secrets of our success.
And that's one of your Ginsu. Sorry, go ahead, please.
The wisdom of Ginsu, I mean, what else would you expect from the Ginsu guys? It's not just one book, Ken. It's actually two books in one.
Uh-huh.
You know, first, it's a great pop culture story about Barry and I who started our careers in a garage with nothing more than our clothes and an idea and ended up living the American dream and creating a cultural icon. And the second part of the book, as Barry mentioned, is a collection of all of the strategies and secrets that we used for the last 30 years to stay one step ahead of the crowd. And I should say, this is the first time we've ever sold anything that's available in stores, because you can also buy the book at Amazon. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble and Borders. It's just a strange thing for us to actually not say, not sold in stores at any price at any time.
Right, that was your shtick for so long.
It sure was.
Now, you guys have actually had three careers, what I call the pre-Ginsu career, and then Ginsu, and all the other things around that, and post-Ginsu. One of the things interesting to me about this book is it's not only very insightful for marketers to read, but anybody managing any kind of a business or anybody who's got to deal with people ever. I mean, there's stuff in here about how to get along with partners, how to deal with difficult people,
right.
How to detect rip-off artists before they, you know, get the knife in your back. I mean, really some hard-earned stuff that I can't recommend too highly.
I think what Bob Rigonti, who is the president, former president of MTV, said on the jacket quote in the back, Barry and I are the Dale Carnegies, how to win friends and influence people for the MTV generation.
Absolutely.
And it's true, because we do have more things available to us today than when Dale Carnegie first wrote his book in the early 1900s. The whole world has changed, not only the way we communicate with one another, but just the way we do business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very contemporary in terms of how to deal with people and how to be successful.
It covers some of the dark side of stuff, too, of business that you have to be hip to if you're going to survive and thrive, which I think is very helpful. To grow a business from a garage to the point where you're booking $500 million in sales over a 10-year period, I mean, you had to learn a tremendous amount about dealing with people.
Well, it's interesting, too, when you talk about $500 million, this was done selling items for $10, $20.
Yeah.
Which makes it even more difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if you're selling aircraft carriers, it's not so hard.
Right.
Selling knife sets for $10 and pots and pans for $20, you got to sell a lot of knives and a lot of pots and pans.
It's remarkable. And, of course, the golden era of your Ginsu style selling was 75 to 85. Is that about right?
That's correct.
That's about right.
Okay. So, basically, the dollar that you made back then really is $2 today. So, we're really talking about adjusted for inflation.
I'll tell you, it's probably closer to $4.
Okay.
Because the $10 stuff that we sold then is at least $40 or $50 now.
Okay. So we're really talking about billions of dollars in today's dollars.
That's right.
So let's talk about that amazing transition. You both had successful careers before you met and before you put together the TV business.
We were young guys, and Ed was about 25 when I met him, and I think I was about 31, 32, something like that.
Okay.
And I owned a couple of AMCO transmission franchises, and Ed was a account exec and running the NBC affiliate in Providence television station.
So he had a lot of great insight into the realities of TV.
Oh, he really did. He handled the record album companies. Pretty much the only thing on TV at that time that was any way direct response were record albums. Like Elvis's greatest hits and Neil Diamond's greatest hits and stuff like that. And Ed was handling those agencies in New York. Now, I was running the transmission shop, and somehow I drew the short straw. and they said, okay, you can handle the advertising for the group here in New England.
Uh-huh.
Didn't know what I was doing anyway, but I got into it. And one day Ed drew the short straw, and he was assigned my account. And I was known to be a real pain in the neck.
Okay.
And so... At that time, I had a 1973 Datsun 240Z. It was orange with a white racing stripe, which was the hot car at the time. It really was. And one day, I'm in my transmission shop, and I look out the window, and I see a 1973 orange Datsun 240Z with a white racing stripe pull right into my lot and park next to mine. I immediately thought, hey, this guy has class, whoever he is, you know. May have transmission trouble. Anyway, it turns out it's Ed.
Okay.
And Ed comes in, and he starts trying to sell me TV time, because we were only doing radio at the time. And he wanted AMCO to advertise on TV.
Okay.
And he was really impressive, and we hit it off. And, you know, right away we had something to talk about with the commonality of our cars. And then it turned out, as our friendship grew, that his wife and my wife had gone to high school together, which was really something. And then one day he said to me, he said, "Barr, these guys are selling some record albums on TV, and they're making a lot of money, and if we could find a product and put it on TV, we could make $1 million. I'll never forget him saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." So I started looking for a product, and I went to a home show, and my wife was asking me to paint the ceilings in the house. We had these acoustic-type ceilings, and she wanted them painted, and I didn't want to paint them. And so there was a guy at a home show, and he took out this device, like a pad, and he soaked it in paint, and he put it in a broomstick, and he started painting a ceiling over his head.
Huh.
And it didn't drip, and it didn't splatter. So I immediately bought one, went home, and painted the ceilings in no time at all, with no drop gloss. And,
wow. That's still impressive 30
yes.
years later.
And I called Ed, and I said, "I got the product."
Huh. And that product became known as the Miracle Painter, primarily because it was a miracle that Barry got up on a ladder and used it.
Exactly, yeah.
See, prior Boy,
to
was
that,
it.
Prior to that, the only thing he ever dipped a brush into was barbecue sauce at a backyard cookout.
Okay.
So it was inevitable that we would call it the Miracle Painter.
And so you just went to one of these shows. Now, did you go to a show looking for products, or were you at the show?
No, I was dragged along, you know, unwillingly. You know,
okay.
What man wants to go to the home show, you know?
Okay. And so there you were being dragged along by your wife,
That's
and you
right.
stumbled on this thing, and you saw the potential in it.
And then you
contacted Ed.
Yes,
exactly
well,
I was
seeing Ed, you know, once a week. We were socially friendly then at the time. Actually, we were selling some TV sets at the time also, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to make a commercial for the product, and we came up with this idea of putting a man in a tuxedo to paint the ceiling. And we came up with a commercial that started off with, "This man is painting a ceiling in a tuxedo with the amazing new Miracle Painter. Throw away your brushes, throw away your rollers. This is all you'll need, etc." And we did all these wonderful demonstrations. And to make a long story short, the first year we sold $1 million at $10 a piece.
Wow.
Yeah, that was good.
I would add, guys, that there's a little piece in there that we should talk about, and we do in the book. It's one of the Ginsuisms. When they say it can't be done, you have to do it yourself. I went to New York with Barry and tried to get my contacts in the ad business to take on the product. And
give us a royalty.
Up and down Madison Avenue so many times that the local panhandlers were starting to get us change.
So you were going to sort of tie it up and then license it to them for TV sales?
Yeah, I mean, we were really looking to keep our careers. I was going to stay in the TV business, and I said if we could get 50 cents or a dollar a piece, that would be great. Excuse me. And everyone that we talked to said, "What's wrong with you people? You can't replace brushes and rollers. This is not going to work."
Wow.
Anyway, we were so determined after that to do it. That we knew we were right and they were wrong, and we would have to do it ourselves. Of course, we also had, Ken, I should mention, historical precedent. We knew that the Titanic was built by experts and Noah's Ark by amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
So we went home and we decided to do it ourselves. And just imagine if we had listened. And in the book, we talk about the fact that many people in positions of authority are constantly telling you what you can and you cannot do. And we tell the story in the book about this particular situation and say at the end of the chapter, just imagine if we had listened, if we had said, "You know what, you guys are right, you can't do this," and walked away from the deal.
Wow.
$10 million later.
So the life.
Wait, is there a lesson here or what?
Wow. So over the lifetime of that particular product, that one product, $10 million in sales.
That was just the first year.
Oh, that was it was $10 million in the first year.
Yeah,
the first year.
Oh my God!
Just imagine if we had listened.
So
not only that,
just,
but we were so successful that we chartered 747 jumbo jets to fly the product over from England, just to keep in pace with the orders.
Incredible! How? Just something to pop into my head. Kind of a strange question, but how did you deal with going from? And you didn't. You weren't at zero because you both had good careers. But how did you go from a normal income to, you know, suddenly bring in $10 million in sales on a single product? I mean, obviously, it wasn't net. You had TV time and product costs, but you must have made a substantial net there.
Well, we certainly did, but, you know, how do you go from it? It's very interesting. You sort of go to work, and you just do your job.
Mm-hmm.
And the income is a byproduct of what you do.
Mm.
So all it means is you can buy a better car, or you can do this, or you can fly first class, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, you go in there and you're working two jobs to start. We both kept our regular jobs and kept doing that for a while until we finally said, "Hey, there's so much money coming in, we got to be crazy not to do this on a full-time basis."
Mm-hmm.
So I sold the transmission business. Ed took his new Mercedes, drove it up on the sidewalk over there at the television station, walked in and said, "See ya."
Happy day.
Yeah, happy day.
And he said to me, why are you quitting? And I said, I just made $10 million. He said, oh, come on, tell me why you're really quitting.
And that's funny because, I mean, you knew as much, or he knew as much, possibly, about TV and the opportunities of selling on TV because you were all working together.
Mm-hmm.
But you figured out how to make it pay off for you in a big way while everyone else was sitting around punching a clock.
Right, and that's part of what we teach the reader who buys our book. To look for those opportunities, you know, the zig and the zag, which is one of our chapters, and how to spot opportunities. I mean, there are opportunities all around us, but we just don't seem to be paying attention anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because most people walk around with blinders. They're sort of walking down one hallway, and they don't veer to the left and veer to the right. They're either afraid to or they don't know how to. And in the book, we really show you step by step how to look for things, how to look for products, how to think differently. How to think out of the box like we do.
And when you guys started, there really was no precedent for what you were doing. I mean, you mentioned the record sales, but selling household items. And
there was no precedent. There were no books. We had to struggle and lose a fortune on the way, just learning
we
how to do everything.
We made it up as we went along. You know, Ed Cannon, sometimes we did something great, and a few times we had some embarrassing failures. But you know what? With each step forward or back, we learned something, and that's what we call a lesson of what we call a Gintsuism.
Not making a mistake is a big mistake. That's one
yes.
of our Gintsuisms.
Great chapter.
You know, great entrepreneurs have to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not taking a chance, you're not a risk taker, and if you're not making a mistake, then you're not learning and you're not growing. Every great entrepreneur will tell you about all of his great successes. They will also tell you about all of their great failures that led to those successes.
Let's talk a little bit about that very first commercial. I guess, you know, obviously both of you had some experience with TV commercials, but this was a very different kind of commercial, right? I mean,
we always felt we had to grab the viewer's attention because all our commercials were 2 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt that, it sucked to get people to watch a 30-second commercial. We had to keep them in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We had to keep them with the commercial for 2 minutes so we could get to the end and close.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we felt that we had to grab their attention at the beginning. So putting a man in a tuxedo painting a ceiling certainly grabbed their attention.
Now, how long did it take, and what was the process for coming up with that particular image and demonstration? Do you remember how you came up with that one?
Gee, that was a long time ago.
I know. But, I mean, let me ask a different question.
Well, I mean, I think I could take a stab at that.
Well, I think it's more in our minds how we came up with Ginsu and Armico and stuff like that.
Well,
I remember, Barry, the creative session about the tuxedo, and it was just what a better way to illustrate no drip, to paint a ceiling in your finest duds. We call that copy today grease copy, Ken, because we feel that if we capture your attention in the first 10 seconds of the commercial, we can slide you into the rest of the spot.
Okay. Okay, and that's, of course, your big challenge in a two-minute spot. You have very little time to get the point across. You've got to be crystal clear.
And we knew there was competition for eyeballs even back then. Imagine what it's like today.
Actually, let's talk a little bit about back then. When did you guys start using 800 numbers and credit cards? Was that right off the bat?
No, it wasn't right off the bat. It was very interesting back then. 800 numbers had just come into fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And most people really didn't believe. There was only one telephone company, then AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And most people didn't believe that an 800 number was free. So in certain markets, you could put an 800 number up, and no one ever called.
Wow.
So you had to get a local answering service with a local number.
Oh, my goodness.
Without an area code, without an 800, and people would call that, and you would get your orders through the answering service that way.
Wow. So not only did you have to run spots in different markets, you had to also set up order taking.
Well, not only order taking in every market, but orders that came in over the phone had to be CODs because there was no way to capture a credit card at the time.
Well, let's tell some of the younger folks what COD means. And this is mind-boggling when you hear it, guys.
Okay. Well, what would happen is we'd put a commercial on TV and we'd put a number, an 800 or a local number. People would call the answering service, and they would take down the person's name and address and say, we will ship this product to you COD.
Okay.
UPS will come to your house and deliver it, and you got to give them the money when they get there.
Cash on delivery, COD.
That's it. And the other orders, which we liked a lot better, were what we call prepaid orders, where the person had to sit down, grab the address that was on the slide at the end of the commercial. They would have to write out a check, put a stamp on it, take it to the mailbox and mail us a check. Those were prepaid orders.
Well, a lot of my listeners I mentioned earlier are internet marketers, and they're so incredibly spoiled because a lot of them are 100% online, 100% credit cards. So they've never had to experience the high, pretty steep mountain to climb of getting somebody to find the envelope, find the checkbook, find the stamp.
It was a tremendous mountain, and I sat down one day a few years back, and I figured out if we had today's credit card system back then,
mm-hmm.
we would have net, $40 million more.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it.
That was what the difference in not having credit card system cost.
Well, we see that with people that have made the transition from, we work with a lot of mail order publishers, people that are selling how-to things, and we've helped a lot of them transition from paper, what we call paper and ink, to online, where they can not only take the order online, but they can use a credit card online as well. And their business is just immediately double, triple, quadruple, without really changing anything else. Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's a tremendous effort.
It also speaks to the time that we were doing this, how compelling the offer had to be.
Exactly.
And how exciting the commercial had to be. Because remember, this was not, if you're in the market for a new muffler, come by. Mm-hmm. Or the next time you're walking down the supermarket aisle, pick us up. This was Act Now marketing. This was immediate. So we had to invoke a response from a viewer that was incredible enough to sit down and write a check and put it in the mail and send it to a stranger.
And what was interesting, too, is you're selling basically, I mean, things that had an edge to them, so to speak, but they were basically common household type of things. I mean, it wasn't something glamorous or dramatic or... But you found ways to make these things dramatic and compelling, and gee, I need to get that right now.
Absolutely. But they are good products.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start with the premise that you need something substantial. The Ginsu knife is just an incredible knife. The fact that it was made in Ohio, wasn't glamorous. The fact that it was an incredibly sharp knife, was just an aside to this. The fact is that everybody needed the Ginsu knife. Did they really know? One of the challenges back then was how do we make someone want a knife when you've got a drawer full of knives?
Exactly, yeah.
So that was the challenge with the Ginsu. But the Ginsu knife had been languishing for years in supermarket shelves.
Oh, it was already available.
Made in, of all places, Fremont, Ohio.
And it had been in supermarkets. They used to put them in bins. And the people would walk by and it would say $2 for this knife or something, or a dollar or whatever it was back then.
Okay.
And basically, that's the way it was sold for, I think, 40 years before we picked up the product.
Sure.
Interesting. Okay.
All we did was give it a totally made-up name, because Ginsu doesn't mean anything in any language except, we never have to work another day in our lives.
That's what Ginsu means.
A totally made-up name, an oriental theme, and a reason to live.
Mm-hmm.
And... $50 million later, think about it. It was just an ordinary-looking product that had an incredible sharpness to it. And we focused on that and just rearranged everything about it, made it like you had to have it. I mean, if your listeners, and including yourself, remember some of the TV parodies with John Belushi.
Absolutely. And
Johnny Carson on a nightly basis.
Yep.
Jerry Seinfeld was on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and said that the Ginsu knife, do you really need a knife that can cut a tire and also a tomato? And Jay Leno said, yeah, but wouldn't it be great to have one?
I mean, I haven't seen that commercial in years. I mean, has it run?
No, it hasn't run probably in 20 years.
It hasn't run in quite a long time, but part of it will run again this fall because with the release of the book, the Ginsu Knife Factory, Warren Buffett has made a silver anniversary set for us, and that's the set that we sell on GinsuGuys.com.
Okay.
Now, this fall, they're releasing a new product, a new Ginsu line, and they're going to use part of the old commercial to introduce it.
Oh, great.
So they're going to be releasing that on national TV, and... I'm going to be working with the factory because I'm the one that still works. I'm not the one that retired.
I am.
Gary.
Hey, congratulations.
So you'll get to see elements of the old commercial again. But it's been parodied. I mean, just 2 days ago, I was contacted by the Discovery Channel, and they're going to feature Ginsu knives on a new HD television program called Pop Nation, which takes a look back at the era. And we've been on many documentaries, the History Channel, Arts and Entertainment, and Discovery Sunday, where they actually go back and show scenes of the old commercial.
Well, the point I want to make about that commercial is, you say it hasn't run in 20 years. I can see it almost frame by frame in my mind's eye at this 20 years later. It was that compelling. So let's break down the ingredients to the Ginsu success. Number one, and I'm glad you pointed this out because sometimes this gets overlooked, you started out with a product of great quality.
Right.
I mean, and it had been around for 40 years. It hadn't been marketed terribly effectively, but it was a great product.
Right.
Number two, you saw that it had potential beyond being in the bin in a supermarket. And that's a fascinating. I didn't realize that was part of the story, that this thing had been around for so many years and, you know, being sold for, you know, spare change. And then number three is you found a way to give it glamour. An exotic appeal.
Well, what we did was we decided that if we said it was made in Ohio, it wasn't going to work.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So we had to find a venue for this to come from, and we started mentally going around the world with it, going to England, and at that time Wilkinson blades were very popular,
mm-hmm.
and we were thinking of you know, sort of ripping off the Wilkinson commercial,
mm-hmm.
having two knives clash to bang together, but we felt then that people would complain that they didn't get two knives, because when we sold the Miracle Paint, that people complained that they didn't get a broomstick. Not a lot, but there were people who said, "Where's my broomstick?" So we wiped that one out, and we went to Germany with German quality steel, but we couldn't come up with a good name because German is a harsh language in that sense.
Sure.
And we went to the Arab countries, Arabia, and we would, you know, with the Sinbad type of thing, and somehow we got to Japan, and we said, "Gee, this is pretty good. They do, you know, samurai swords." But this was almost called the samurai set.
Uh-huh.
And it was almost called the Harikari set, but our attorney's advice was not to do it.
That would have been very expensive.
Right. But the interesting thing was Ed was into karate at the time. He was you know, taking those karate classes and all that stuff. So Japan sort of appealed to us, and we came up with this idea that we'd have Ed karate chop. Now think about this. We're going to sell knives.
Yeah.
So we have him karate chop a board, mm-hmm. and then we have him karate chop a tomato.
Exactly.
What does that have to do with selling knives?
Okay.
Nothing, but we made it work because we got to grab the viewer and we got to keep him in the commercial. So we said, in Japan, the hand can be used as a knife. And Ed goes whammo right through a 2x4. But that doesn't work on a tomato, and he splats right through a tomato. And people looked at the commercial and said, what the heck is going on here? What is this? I got to see this. Now we got them watching. Now we just have to take them through it. And we had to do product selection also because we didn't just sell the knife. We sold the knife, plus we sold the fork, plus we sold a spiral slicer for potatoes and a decorating tool, and then we threw in 6 steak knives. So now you were getting 10 knives for $10.
Hmm. Incredible.
You know, in the book, The Wisdom of Ginsu, we tell the story like Barry has been telling your listeners, but we tell it in our own voices. I don't know if you've noticed that or not.
Yes.
We actually tell the reader what we were thinking at the time. There's an interplay between Barry and I. What did you think? What did you think? Back and forth. And I think that's what makes the story and the lesson so readable, because we just speak to one another. And I say to Barry at that time, as much as I can remember, exactly what I was thinking. What did I think about the knife? What did I think about this knife? What did I think about the commercial? And we just, you know, we tell a conversation about what was going on some 27 years ago.
Yeah, the book is almost like a dialogue.
Yeah.